What if I told you that the water inside your cells, like the water that makes up the vast majority of your physical body, isn't actually liquid?
Which I know sounds completely insane.
Right. It sounds like science fiction. But what if that single, seemingly bizarre biophysical fact changes absolutely everything we know about chronic pain, mysterious fatigue, and just, well, the fundamental nature of how we heal?
Yeah, it is the very frontier of modern biology right now. We're learning that the assumptions we've made about the fundamental materials of the human body have basically been missing a massive piece of the puzzle.
Okay, so keep that idea of the non-liquid water in the back of your mind, because to understand why that matters, I want you to picture a scenario, and it's one that is probably, incredibly familiar to a lot of you listening, and honestly, incredibly frustrating.
Oh, absolutely. The medical runaround.
Exactly. Let's say you've been feeling just awful for months. You go to a gastroenterologist because your stomach is constantly upset. Maybe you're getting like bizarre food reactions.
Right, so they look at the gut.
Yeah. Then you head over to a rheumatologist because your joints are aching inexplicably. Finally, you end up at a neurologist or a sleep specialist because your fatigue is just, it's so profound you can barely think straight. You've got this constant heavy brain fog.
And let me guess, you leave with three different prescriptions.
Exactly. Three different prescriptions, maybe three different minor, highly localized diagnoses. But you essentially feel like your body is being treated as a collection of completely disconnected parts.
Yeah, that's the classic experience.
It's like taking a sputtering, smoking car to three different mechanics who absolutely refuse to speak to one another. And one just looks at the tires, one looks at the AC, and one looks at the radio.
That is a deeply isolating experience. And I mean, I speak to people all the time who are trapped in that exact loop. Because from the inside, you don't experience yourself as a collection of separate broken parts.
No, of course not. You just feel sick.
Right. You feel like one single unified organism that is failing all at once.
Yeah.
And yet, the medical system you are navigating is structurally designed to slice your experience up into specialty-specific categories.
And that feeling of fragmentation, that deep intuition you have that your body isn't actually a bunch of isolated parts acting up randomly, is the exact premise of our deep dive today.
And it's a huge premise.
It really is. We are looking at a truly fascinating body of research grounded in a white paper by Dr. Bechara Saheli. And what's incredible here is that he utilized AI analytical tools to help synthesize a massive, almost unmanageable amount of cross-disciplinary research to pull this together.
It's titled Tour to Coherence Physiology.
Right. And our mission today is pretty ambitious. We're going to completely tear down this idea of the human body as an organ assemblage. A biological bag holding a bunch of separate parts, and we're going to rebuild it from the ground up as a nested continuum.
The stakes here could not be higher. I mean, this is not just some academic debate about anatomical definitions or like how we label things in a textbook.
No, it has real-world impact.
Exactly. This is about completely redefining how we understand chronic illness, because modern medicine is an absolute marvel when it comes to acute trauma.
Oh, for sure. If I get hit by a bus, take me to a standard ER.
Right. If you have a ruptured appendix, a blocked artery, a shattered femur, you want the acute compartmentalized medical model. It will save your life.
But chronic stuff is different.
Completely different. As this synthesis points out, that same prevailing architecture struggles immensely with chronic, multi-system, or mysterious conditions, the fatigue syndromes, the diffuse pain, the dysautonomia.
Why does it struggle so much, though?
Well, it struggles because it's frantically searching for a single broken part in a system where the parts aren't actually separate to begin with.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this research links everything from the actual physical state of the water inside our cells all the way up to our psychological stress. And it does so in a way that actually makes biological sense.
It really does. It connects the dots.
So, to start rebuilding this model of the body, we have to look at the very foundation, the scaffolding. When we look at those classic anatomy posters in a doctor's office, we see the heart, the liver, the lungs, the muscles. They're all distinct, color-coded, and cleanly separated.
Like a jigsaw puzzle.
Exactly. But to get the body to look like that, didn't anatomists historically have to strip away a ton of material?
That is exactly the right place to start. For centuries, when medical students dissected cadavers, they were taught to cut away and discard this pervasive white web-like tissue to get to the important stuff.
The organs and bones?
Right. The distinct muscles, the bones. That discarded material is the fascia.
Fascia, okay.
And the old organ assemblage model essentially treats that connective tissue and the space between the organs as entirely passive. It was viewed as packing peanuts.
Biological packing peanuts.
Basically, yeah. Just biological bubble wrap designed to keep your liver from bumping into your stomach when you jump up and down.
Right. I mean, if you asked me a few years ago, I would have said fascia is just that annoying white gristle you have to cut off a chicken breast before you cook it.
That's how most people think of it.
But the current research describes it completely differently. It says we need to break down the true nature of fascia because it is a three-dimensional, body-wide, mechanosensitive, and fluid-linked continuum.
That's a lot of big words, but it's precise.
Yeah, hold on. I need to translate that for myself. Yeah. So body-wide continuum means it doesn't just stop and start at the joints.
Far from it. You do not just have muscles and bones floating in empty space. Every single structure in your body, every nerve, every blood vessel, every organ, down to the individual muscle fibers, is permeated, enclosed, and suspended by this continuous fascial web.
Wow. So it's all one piece.
It is. The fascia wrapping around the muscles in your ankle is functionally and physically woven into the fascia, traveling up your leg, through your pelvis, and all the way up into your neck. It's one single net.
And you use the word mechanosensitive. That feels like the game changer here.
It absolutely is.
It sounds like it means it can feel things, like it has sensation.
It means this web is densely packed with sensory nerve endings. It actually feels mechanical force. It senses stretch, compression, and tension. And it distributes that tension globally. So it's not just wrapping paper. It is literally the largest sensory organ in the human body.
That is wild. The largest sensory organ. And within this webbing, there's a concept I came across in the material called the interstitium, which sounds a bit like a sci-fi dimension, honestly.
It does sound like something from a movie.
Right. But as I understand it, it's basically the fluid-filled space within this fascial web.
That's a really good way to visualize it.
Yeah.
For a long time, anatomy largely ignored these fluid-filled spaces, treating them as incidental, just empty gaps. But the interstitium is a pervasive, fluid-filled connective architecture.
Like an internal ocean?
Sort of. Think of it as the liquid environment that the solid fascial scaffolding sits inside. The research uses a beautiful framework called the RAIN model to explain this regional anatomy and interstitial network.
Okay, the RAIN model.
Yeah. It suggests we shouldn't just think of anatomy as solid objects. We have solid fascia, which is the collagen web providing our physical form and tension. And we have liquid fascia, which includes blood, lymph, and interstitial fluid.
Oh, so blood is considered liquid fascia?
In this model, yes.
Right.
This liquid fascia is what sustains the constant exchange of nutrients, waste, and information.
Solid and liquid fascia. Man, that completely shatters how I view my body. So the body is structurally integrated before it is functionally compartmentalized.
It's the exact phrase to remember.
The argument here is that a strain or a pathology in one part of the fluid or fascial area inevitably alters the sensory input and the mechanical load of the whole entire system.
Yes. You can't change one part without the rest feeling it.
Let me try an analogy here to see if I'm getting this. It feels like the old medical model is trying to understand a massive, complex highway system by taking a microscope and only studying the individual cars.
I like where this is going.
Right. So they are looking at a Honda Civic and saying, well, the engine works perfectly. I don't know why you aren't moving. But they are completely ignoring the roads, the bridges, the traffic signals, and the weather conditions on the asphalt.
That is a phenomenal analogy. If there is a massive traffic jam, staring at the spark plugs of one single car won't tell you why the system is halted.
Because the car isn't the problem. The network is.
Exactly. You have to look at the network. The road itself, the fascia, and the interstitium dictates the behavior of the cars.
Okay, so let me challenge you on this or push back on how far this actually goes in real life. If everything is connected by this continuous matrix, does that mean a localized injury, say, a really severe ankle sprain from playing basketball 10 years ago, could legitimately cause a seemingly unrelated symptom elsewhere?
It absolutely could.
Like, could an old ankle injury actually be the root cause of chronic neck pain or a localized fluid backup in my shoulder simply because the chassis of my body is pulled out of alignment?
Well, let's look at the mechanics of it. The body operates as a tensegrity structure, which we'll get into deeper shortly, but essentially it's a web of tension. If you take a large fishing net and pull sharply on one bottom corner, what happens?
The holes in the net at the top corner distort and stretch.
Exactly. The tension is distributed across the entire net. A severe localized injury changes how you distribute mechanical load.
So I limp, basically.
Right. You suddenly change your gait to protect the ankle. That subtle change alters the tension on the fascia in your knee, which alters your hip, which pulls asymmetrically on the fascia of your spine right up to your neck.
Wow. Just from an ankle sprain.
Yeah. And because we just established that the interstitium is fluid-linked, it's that liquid highway. A sustained structural twisting in the neck, fascia can literally compress the local lymphatic vessels.
Like stepping on a garden hose.
Perfectly said.
Mm.
That compression alters how fluid flows and how inflammatory signals are cleared out of that completely different part of the body. You are integrated before you are separated.
Okay, so we've established this incredibly dynamic physical matrix. We have the solid scaffolding of the fascia, pulling and sensing, and the liquid highways of the interstitium.
The solid and the liquid.
Right. But this raises a huge question. If we have this massive interconnected highway system, what actually fills it? What is the environment where all this happens? We have to move from the scaffolding of life to the actual medium of life.
And this is where it gets really mind-bending.
Yeah, this is where we get back to that crazy idea I teased at the very beginning. Let's talk about the water.
This is a pivotal transition.
Yeah.
Because acknowledging the continuous connective tissue is only part of the story. You have to ask, how does the fundamental substance of life, water, behave inside this matrix?
Because we're mostly water, right?
Mostly water by volume,
right,
and overwhelmingly water by molecule count. The synthesis leans heavily into the work of Dr. Gerald Pollack regarding interfacial water, arguing that this provides what researchers call substrate-level explanatory leverage.
Okay, substrate-level explanatory leverage. That's a mouthful.
It's very academic.
Let's translate that. I'm assuming substrate means the foundational base layer.
Yes. It means that if we truly understand the foundational material, the water, and the tissue base, it gives us the leverage to explain a whole bunch of higher-level biological mysteries that otherwise seem like magic.
Oh, I see.
For decades, biology has treated water in the body as just a passive bulk solvent.
Bulk solvent, like a bathtub.
Think of a bathtub full of lukewarm water, where you just drop in chemicals and watch them bump into each other and react. In that model, the water is just the background. It's politically neutral, so to speak. It doesn't participate.
Right. It's just the empty space where the important stuff happens. But Pollack's work and the research highlighted here suggests that water in the body is almost entirely not passive bulk water.
Not at all.
The concept here is that at hydrophilic surfaces, meaning surfaces that naturally attract or love water, like cell membranes, proteins, and all that dense collagen in the fascia we just talked about, water enters a highly ordered state. It fundamentally changes its physical structure.
That's the paradigm shift right there. When water molecules sit next to these biological surfaces, they don't just slosh around randomly. They organize.
They line up.
They form a highly structured, crystalline-like lattice. Dr. Pollack often refers to it as the fourth phase of water, or exclusion zone EZ water. It becomes more like a gel.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. I've always thought of the human body as just a sack of liquids, mostly empty space filled with water. We've treated the water in us like the empty space in a room, but it's actually an active, responsive medium.
It is the medium.
But how does water becoming a gel actually change anything about how I feel or function, like practically?
Well, it changes everything about local cellular environments.
Sure.
First, this ordered gel state changes exclusion behavior.
Meaning what?
Meaning the structured water physically pushes out certain solutes, toxins, and protons, creating pristine zones. It excludes them.
Oh, so it cleans the area around the tissue.
Exactly. Second, it changes viscosity, which impacts how easily proteins can fold or how molecules travel through the space.
Right.
But most importantly, the formation of this structured water causes charge separation.
Okay, pause. Charge separation. Like a battery.
Very much like a battery.
Yeah.
In bulk water, positive and negative charges are mixed randomly. But when water structures itself against a protein surface, the structured layer typically becomes negatively charged, and it pushes the positive protons out into the bulk fluid beyond it.
Wow.
So you now have a negative zone right next to a positive zone. You've created a tiny biological battery. You have potential energy where previously we thought there was just inert liquid.
That is mind-blowing. Our bodies are basically filled with millions of tiny batteries made of gel water.
That's one way to look at it, yes.
But I want to make sure we are staying grounded here. I know the scientific community can be highly skeptical when we start talking about, like, magic water or whatever. How solid is the science? Are we talking about proving facts or just cool theories?
That is a critical distinction. and the researchers involved in this synthesis are very disciplined about it. They present a clear evidence gradient for this theory to maintain what they call epistemic hygiene.
Epistemic hygiene, I like that.
Right. So level one consists of direct observations. We can physically observe in a laboratory setting that water alters its state, its viscosity, and its exclusion behavior at biological interfaces. That is strongly supported and well documented.
Okay, so the gel phase is a proven physical reality, level one.
Yes. Then level two involves biologically plausible inferences. Because we know the water structures and separates charge, it's highly plausible that this gel-like water affects how physical force and energy move through our cells and tissues.
It's the logical next step based on the data. And then there's level three, right? The frontier stuff.
Yes, level three are the exploratory frontier claims. These are the more radical hypotheses. For example, the idea that this interfacial water might be the primary explanation for the electrical resting potential of all cell membranes, rather than just the classic ion pump model.
Wow. That would rewrite the textbooks.
It would. And the synthesis maintains transparency by clearly separating the laboratory facts of level one from the bold hypotheses of level three.
That's great to hear, because we don't even need to jump to level three to see how revolutionary this is. Even just sticking to the proven observations that water structures itself and separates charge along our connective tissue, it answers a massive question.
What question is that?
Well, we just talked about this continuous fascial web stretching from our ankle to our neck. How does it send signals so incredibly fast across the whole body?
Yes. You're touching on the exact biophysical link we've been missing.
Right. If the water coating all that collagen isn't just sloshing random liquid, but a highly ordered charge-separated gel, it becomes an incredibly efficient medium for conducting electrical and physical signals almost instantaneously.
It's lightning fast.
The water is the wire.
The water is the wire. The collagen provides the structural track, and the ordered water provides the conductivity.
Okay, so if we have this conductive water acting as a wire, what is the actual signal traveling through it? Like, how does the body press send?
That's where we have to look at physical force. We aren't just communicating with chemical hormones floating in the blood. We are communicating through tension.
Tension.
Yes. Which brings us to the concept of mechanobiology and the architectural framework of the body known as biotensegrity. Force is a primary language of the living body.
Biotensegrity. I love this concept. So tensegrity is an architectural term originally, like those incredible sculptures made of wires and metal rods that look like they're magically floating in midair.
That's the origin, yes. Coined by Buckminster Fuller and Kenneth Snelson.
Right.
Tensegrity relies on distributed relationships of continuous tension, those are the cables, mm-hmm. and discontinuous compression, those are the struts. Let's contrast it with how we usually build things. If you build a brick wall, it relies entirely on gravity, pushing weight straight down.
Yeah, the bottom brick bears the weight of every brick above it.
Exactly. And if you remove a bottom brick, the wall collapses.
Right, compressive load.
But the human body isn't a brick wall. Living tissues maintain their structural integrity through biotensegrity. Our bones are the discontinuous struts. They don't actually touch each other directly. They float in the joint spaces.
Wait, our bones don't touch?
Not directly. They are buffered by cartilage and suspended. And our fascia, muscles, and tendons are the continuous tension cables holding it all together.
So we are basically suspension bridges.
Very much so.
Huh.
In a tensegrity structure, if you apply force to one area, the stress isn't localized. It is instantly distributed globally across the entire tension network.
And because the body operates this way, we have a phenomenon called mechanotransduction. The definition here is key. It's the conversion of mechanical stimuli like a physical pull, a stretch, tension, or pressure into biochemical and electrical responses inside the body.
That translation from physical to chemical is the core of mechanobiology.
But I want to push back, or rather get you to explain the actual mechanics of this, because I read the part about the cytoskeleton and the genes, and I couldn't really wrap my head around it.
It's a tricky concept to visualize.
Yeah. It's easy to see how a whole muscle reacts to force. I lift a heavy weight. The muscle fiber tears slightly and it grows back bigger. But is this research really saying that purely physical tension in the connective tissue can actually change what a single cell's DNA is doing down in the nucleus?
It absolutely does. And the mechanism is fascinating. We used to think of a cell like a balloon filled with water, just floating passively. But cells are actually rigidly structured inside by a scaffolding called the cytoskeleton.
So they have their own little internal skeleton?
Yes. Now imagine this cell is anchored into the surrounding fascial web by little hook-like proteins called integrins. They physically tie the inside of the cell to the outside world.
Okay, so the cell is tethered to the collagen highway.
Right. Now, what happens when that external collagen highway gets stiff? Say you have an injury and the tissue gets dense and fibrous. That stiff tissue pulls on the integrin hooks.
And the hooks pull the cell.
The hooks pull on the cell cytoskeleton. And here is the magic. That internal cytoskeleton is physically, mechanically linked directly to the nuclear envelope.
The vault that holds the DNA.
Exactly, the vault. Mm. When the outside tissue pulls, it transmits that physical force all the way down to forming the nucleus.
Yeah.
And that physical stretching literally pulls the chromatin apart, exposing different genes to be transcribed into proteins.
You're kidding.
No. You have changed the genetic behavior of the cell just by altering the physical tension of the environment it lives in.
That is astonishing. A physical pull from a stiff muscle reaches all the way down and opens up a different chapter in the DNA recipe book.
It's beautiful, really.
It is. And that perfectly explains what the research calls the pathology of force. What happens when this physical communication system goes wrong? When we have an injury, our tissues stiffen up to protect us, right? Like a splint.
Yes, that's called tissue guarding.
Or we form a scar, which is fibrosis. But if that temporary protective guarding persists long after the injury is healed, it becomes a chronic maladaptive signal.
Yes. The body physically remembers the perturbation. If you have a deep fibrotic scar from a surgery or from a severe repetitive strain, that dense tissue is constantly pulling on the surrounding fascial web.
It's constantly tugging on those hooks.
Exactly. And because of mechanotransduction, that physical pull is continuously whispering or shouting to the surrounding cells, we are under threat, we are injured, stiffen up, prepare for damage.
Wow.
The mechanical force itself is acting as chronic biological information.
This makes so much sense of chronic pain. It's like trying to turn off a blaring fire alarm in a building by putting a thick blanket over the speaker. You know, maybe taking ibuprofen or chemical anti-inflammatory pill.
It muffles the sound.
Right. It might muffle the sound for a few hours, but someone is still standing there physically pulling the fire alarm lever down. You have to address the physical lever. You have to relieve the mechanical tension.
You can't out-medicate a mechanical problem.
Exactly. So we have the force of physical tension in the matrix. But force isn't just the pull of fascia. It's also the physical force of fluids flowing through us.
Yeah.
We need to transition from the physical tension of the matrix to the intelligence of our blood vessels.
Yes. We are zooming in on the endothelium, which is the single cell thick inner lining of all our blood vessels.
Right.
For a very long time, cardiovascular medicine effectively treated blood vessels as inert pipes. Just passive plumbing designed to carry blood from point A to the organs in point B.
Yeah, the classic plumbing analogy. If the pipe gets clogged with plaque, you have a heart attack. If the pipe is clear, you're totally fine.
But modern microvascular research completely tears this idea apart. The endothelium is not a passive pipe. It is an active, highly distributed organ of interpretation. It's a sensory organ in its own right.
And the absolute star of this sensory organ is a structure I am newly obsessed with. The endothelial glycocalyx.
It's an amazing structure.
I love learning terms like this. The text describes it as a hydrated, gel-like, luminal structure. Hold on, let me try to visualize this. It's basically a microscopic, highly charged, fuzzy forest lining the inside of every single blood vessel in the body.
That is a very accurate visual. Imagine millions of tiny hair-like sugar protein structures extending from the wall of the vessel out into the flowing bloodstream.
Like sea anemones waving in the current.
Exactly like that. And here is where mechanobiology comes back. As the blood rushes past, it physically bends and tugs on those little fuzzy hairs. The glycocalyx literally reads the shear stress, the physical friction of the blood flow. And through specialized mechanosensitive ion channels, like one called Piazza-1, it translates that physical bending into biochemical signals.
It feels the flow and then it reacts. And the main reaction is releasing nitric oxide, right?
Primarily, yes. Nitric oxide tells the smooth muscle around the blood vessel to relax and dilate. So the vessel is constantly feeling the demand of the blood flow and adjusting its own diameter in real time.
That's so smart.
But the glycocalyx also acts as a selective barrier. It decides which immune cells are allowed to attach and leave the bloodstream and which nutrients are allowed to pass into the surrounding tissues.
So it's feeling the crowd, adjusting the hallways, and checking passports.
Very much so.
But what happens when this goes wrong? The research introduces something called the panvascular model of microvascular dysfunction.
Yes. This is crucial for chronic disease.
We normally think of conditions like retinopathy disease of the small vessels in the eyes, which can cause blindness, or nephropathy disease of the small vessels in the kidneys, or coronary microvascular dysfunction in the heart.
Right, highly localized diseases.
Under the old model, you go to an ophthalmologist for your eyes, a nephrologist for your kidneys, and a cardiologist for your heart. They are treated as completely separate diseases.
But the panvascular model argues that they are not separate diseases at all. They are parallel, local expressions of a systemic failure of exchange intelligence.
Exchange intelligence.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the microcirculation, those miles and miles of tiny capillary beds where the glycocalyx lives, is where systemic conditions become local tissue realities.
Meaning what, exactly?
If you suffer from chronic metabolic stress, like consistently high blood sugar from diabetes, or systemic inflammation from an autoimmune issue, that stress physically degrades and shreds that fuzzy glycocalyx forest everywhere in the body.
So the fuzzy hairs are basically burnt off or shaved down.
Yes, they are destroyed.
Yeah.
Let me build on my earlier thought to give the listener a way to really grasp this. Imagine your blood vessels aren't just plumbing, but the walls are lined with millions of tiny, highly trained border agents. That's the glycocalyx.
I like this.
Their job is to constantly feel the flow of the crowd, check the molecular passports, and decide who gets oxygen and who needs waste removed. But if that glycocalyx gets damaged by metabolic stress, does that mean the border agents essentially go blind?
And if they are blind, they can't open the gates, meaning the tissues on the other side start suffocating, even if the main large arteries are wide open.
Yes, and to take your border agent analogy a step further, imagine what happens when those border agents are forced to work 72-hour shifts in a hostile environment. Because of chronic inflammation.
They just collapse.
Exactly. They stop functioning properly. They stop releasing nitric oxide. The gates clamp shut. You could have a perfectly clear aorta, no plaque in your major arteries whatsoever. But if the microcirculation of the border agents are blind and dysfunctional, the tissue on the other side of that barrier is effectively suffocating.
It can't breathe.
It cannot get the oxygen it needs to make energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it cannot clear its toxic metabolic waste.
That is a chilling thought. But it's incredibly validating for anyone dealing with unexplained fatigue. It perfectly explains why someone with a chronic illness can feel profound, crushing fatigue and muscle pain, yet when they go to the cardiologist, their standard macrovascular ultrasound comes back completely normal.
Everything looks fine, they're told.
Right. The big pipes are open, but the exchange intelligence at the capillary level has completely failed. So if the blood vessels are the border agents controlling the exchange of resources, who dictates how the cell actually spends those resources?
We have to keep zooming in.
Right. We've looked at the roads, we've looked at the borders, now we need to zoom all the way inside the cell. Who is running the factory?
That brings us to the mitochondria.
Ah, the mitochondria. Most of us learn the exact same phrase in middle school biology. The mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell.
The classic textbook line.
Right. They are the little ATP energy factories.
And while they do produce ATP, the cellular energy currency, this synthesis insists that defining them merely as subordinate, mindless factories is dangerously incomplete. It misses their primary role.
The research calls them the executive regulators of the organism's adaptive state. So they aren't just the blue-collar workers shoveling coal into the furnace. They are the executives in the boardroom deciding what the entire factory should be doing based on the state of the economy.
Precisely. Or rather, that is a much more accurate framework. This is where we dive into the brilliant work of Dr. Robert Navio and his concept of the cell danger response, or CDR.
Okay, the cell danger response.
Navio discovered that the CDR is a deeply ancient, evolutionarily conserved program. When a cell perceives danger, and that danger could be a viral invasion, an environmental toxin, severe physical trauma, or even a profound psychological shock, the mitochondria act as the primary sensors.
They sense the threat.
And when they sense that threat, they completely shift their behavior.
They stop making energy for everyday use. The text says they shift from normal function, which is growth, differentiation, digesting food, just living life, into defense, containment, and survival mode.
They purposefully and strategically downregulate energy production for normal tasks. They alter the cell membrane. They stiffen the cell.
Just battening down the hatches.
And remarkably, they actually release ATP, the energy molecule itself, outside the cell.
Wait, they throw the fuel out?
Yes. In the extracellular space, ATP acts as a potent danger signal to neighboring cells. The mitochondria are essentially pulling the biological fire alarm.
Wow. And this connects directly to another area of research that absolutely blew my mind, Martin Picard's work on mitochondrial psychobiology. I had to read this section twice.
It's revolutionary work.
It really is. Picard's work shows that mitochondria literally transduce lived psychosocial stress into a biological state.
Yes.
Meaning your emotional trauma, your chronic stress at work, or the anxiety of a toxic relationship is physically heard by your mitochondria, and they alter the cellular energy output in response.
They react to the emotional environment just like a physical virus.
There is no separation between mind and body at the mitochondria level. Experience and cellular energy are biologically continuous.
It forces us to abandon the dualism of mind and body entirely. Psychological stress alters hormones and neural tone, which alters the physical tension in the fascia, which is transmitted through the interfacial water directly to the cell, where the mitochondria read it as a threat to survival.
It's all connected.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this completely reframes the most confusing symptoms of chronic illness. Let's look at what is called the energy resistance principle.
Energy resistance.
Chronic illness fundamentally involves an inability to effectively transform energy into coordinated function, leading to a state of hypometabolism. The cells are literally running on low power.
But, and this is the mind-blowing part for me, they aren't running on low power because they are broken. They haven't run out of fuel.
Exactly. It's not a defect. It's a defense.
Mm.
The symptoms that chronic fatigue patients report, the crushing brain fog, the extreme heaviness in their limbs, the terrifying phenomenon of post-exertional malaise where trying to exercise makes them crash for days.
Yeah.
These aren't random, chaotic system failures.
They aren't just lazy or broken.
They are the result of the body purposefully rationing energy because the mitochondria fundamentally believe they are under active siege.
I have to use an analogy here because it's the only way I can picture it. I'm imagining the mitochondria as the director of a major city's power grid.
Let's hear it.
Under normal, safe conditions, the power is flowing everywhere. The amusement parks are running. The streetlights are bright. The factories are humming. The music venues are loud. Everything is great.
Flourishing.
Right. But suddenly, the director of the power grid gets a frantic report that the city is under imminent attack by a foreign army. What do? They don't just keep running the Ferris wheels.
Of course not.
They immediately cut the power to the amusement parks. That's your exercise capacity and your libido. They dim the streetlights and close the libraries. That's your brain fog and lack of concentration. And they route every last drop of available energy to the defense shields, the radar systems, and the perimeter alarms.
And if there actually is a foreign army attacking, say, a severe acute viral infection, there's a brilliant life-saving survival strategy. You hunker down, you feel terrible and sleep for a week, you fight off the invader, and you survive.
But here is my pushback, or rather, the terrifying question this raises. What happens if the alarm gets stuck on? What if the viral army is defeated and leaves, but the director of the power grid never gets the all-clear signal? What if the communication lines are cut?
Then you have a chronic illness.
Wow.
The city survives the initial attack, but it becomes locked in a dark, hypometabolic state of perpetual defense. The amusement parks stay closed forever. The streetlights stay dim. The citizens are exhausted.
Just constantly bracing for an attack that's already over.
And this perfectly bridges us to the next layer of the continuum. Because you have to ask, who is feeding the power grid director this bad information? If the mitochondria are hitting the alarm button inside the cell, who is tripping the perimeter sensors on the outside of the cell? Who's yelling that the army is still there?
Which takes us to the sentinels of the body's borders. We are looking at mast cells and local intelligence.
Yes, mast cells.
Now, when most people, even many doctors, hear the term mast cells, they immediately think of allergies. You eat a peanut you shouldn't have, or you breathe in spring pollen, your mast cells degranulate, meaning they explode and release histamine and you get hives, or your throat swells, or you start sneezing.
That is the classical narrow effector view of mast cells. They are just the allergy alarms.
But that view is changing rapidly. The new paradigm redefines them entirely. It says boundaries in the body aren't passive edges. They are biologically intelligent zones monitored by tissue-resident sentinels. And mast cells are ancient.
They are incredibly ancient, evolutionarily speaking. And their positioning is what makes them so crucial. They don't just float in the blood. They are tissue resident.
They live in the tissues.
They are strategically planted everywhere your body meets the outside world or everywhere different biological systems intersect. They're positioned at the critical intersections of blood vessels, nerve endings, the fascial connective tissue, and epithelial barriers like the mucosal lining of your gut, your lungs, and your skin.
They are the ultimate border guards.
They really are.
So what are they actually doing if they aren't just waiting to make me sneeze at a cat?
Their job is to monitor and manage local tissue homeostasis. They regulate vascular permeability.
Meaning they tell the blood vessels when to open up and leak fluid?
Yes. When they release histamine, it causes local vasodilation and makes the blood vessels leaky, which allows immune cells to rush in. That's why a mosquito bite swells up.
Oh, that makes total sense.
But beyond that, they manage neuroimmune crosstalk, meaning they talk directly to your nerve endings, altering pain sensitivity, and they initiate the tissue repair cascade after an injury.
So they're orchestrating the whole response.
They are the local commanders. They translate a local perturbation, a toxin, a mechanical strain in the fascia, or a bacterial fragment into organism-wide consequences.
Okay, let me ask you this, because this is where the whole puzzle seems to snap together for me. We know mast cells are positioned everywhere, from the gut lining to the brain. Could a persistent activation of these sentinels in one localized place, let's say, a chronically leaky gut, where the mast cells are constantly freaking out and fighting off undigested food proteins and bacterial endotoxins, could that local alarm in the stomach trigger a system-wide lockdown of the whole organism?
Without a doubt. And mapping that exact pathway perfectly connects all the systems we've discussed so far.
Really? Walk me through it.
Think about how those mast cells in the gut trigger that lockdown. They degranulate, releasing a storm of inflammatory mediators, cytokines, and histamine. These mediators directly damage and alter the endothelial glycocalyx, our border agents in the local blood vessels.
Okay, so the blood vessels get damaged.
Right. This impairs exchange and causes localized hypoxia. Simultaneously, the inflammatory mediators alter the physical tension and viscosity of the surrounding fascial matrix. The tissue becomes stiff and dense.
So now we have low oxygen and stiff connective tissue.
And crucially, these chemical and mechanical distress signals travel through the interstitial fluid and the fascial web. And who is listening to the environment to decide if the body is safe?
The mitochondria.
Yes. Oh. When the mitochondria in distant tissues sense the systemic hypoxia, the mechanical tension from the stiff fascia, and the inflammatory cytokines from the mast cells, they read the environment as hostile.
And they pull the alarm.
They shift into the cell danger response.
Mm-hmm.
They shut down the power grid.
So a local leaky gut triggers the mast cell sentinel, which degrades the blood vessel border agent, which stiffens the fascial highway, which warns the mitochondrial power grid director, who shuts down energy production in your brain and muscles.
It's a massive biological chain reaction.
And that leads us to the darkest, but perhaps the most profoundly illuminating part of this deep dive. Let's look at what this research calls defensive lock-in, which is a complete redefinition of what chronic illness actually is.
Up to this point, we have successfully built the nested continuum. We have this sensory fascial web, the highly conductive interfacial water, the physical communication of biotensegrity, the intelligent blood vessels, the executive mitochondria, and the sentinel mast cells.
They're all linked.
They're all intimately coupled together. Now we must ask, what happens when this entire beautifully coordinated system gets trapped?
Well, the standard medical model views chronic illness as the continued presence of a pathogen, like a persistent virus, or a single broken part, like a faulty thyroid gland. But this synthesis argues that chronic illness is fundamentally defensive lock-in.
To understand this, we have to trace what the research describes as a convergent downward cascade.
A downward spiral.
It always starts with an initial trigger. Mm. And because the body is a nested continuum, the trigger can come from anywhere. It could be a severe toxic mold exposure in a water-damaged building. It could be a massive acute viral infection like COVID or Epstein-Barr. It could be a severe physical trauma like a car accident. Or it could be a prolonged period of inescapable psychosocial trauma.
Okay, so the trigger hits. What happens next? Let's trace it slowly.
First, the trigger alters the foundational substrate. The physical matrix, the fascia, stiffens up in a protective guarding response. The interfacial water may lose its highly ordered structure due to the stress.
And because the fascia stiffens, it mechanically signals danger to the cells through mechanotransduction. The physical pull on the nucleus says, we are under attack.
Simultaneously, the stress and initial inflammation cause the endothelial glycocalyx in the blood vessels to degrade. The fuzzy forest is sheared away.
Right. Our border agents are blinded.
This causes microvascular dysfunction, drastically reducing the delivery of oxygen and nutrients to the deep tissues.
which creates a highly toxic, suffocating environment. So the mitochondria sense this low oxygen, they feel the mechanical tension from the fascia, and they react by shifting into the cell danger response, shutting down normal energy production to preserve resources.
And because the tissue is hypoxic, stiff, and lacking energy, the sentinel mast cells sense this widespread tissue distress. They stay persistently alarmed.
Just constantly firing.
Constantly releasing histamine and inflammatory cytokines, which in turn keeps the blood vessels inflamed and the fascia stiff.
And here's the absolute crux of the issue, the crucial insight that changes everything. The original trigger, the virus, the mold exposure, the stressful life event might be completely 100% gone.
Yes, the trigger's gone.
The mold was remediated years ago. The virus was cleared by the immune system. The stressful job was quit. These layers, the fascia, the endothelium, the mitochondria, the mast cells, they are now mutually reinforcing each other.
They're stuck.
The mast cells keep the fascia stiff. The stiff fascia scares the mitochondria. The mitochondria signal danger to the mast cells. The body is now trapped in a self-stabilizing configuration of dysfunction.
It is a self-sustaining loop. The initial threat is gone, but the alarm system is powering itself.
It's like a Mexican standoff where everyone has their guns drawn. The mast cell has a gun pointed at the mitochondria. The mitochondria has a gun pointed at the blood vessel. The blood vessel is pointing at the fascia.
That's a perfect visual.
The original bad guy who started the fight left through the back door an hour ago, but no one can put their gun down because if the mast cell lowers its weapon, it sees the mitochondria still has its gun raised, so it keeps firing.
Right. And this model perfectly explains multi-system illnesses. The text mentions CIRS, or chronic inflammatory response syndrome, which is often triggered by mold or tick-borne infections.
Yeah, CIRS is a brutal illness.
Yes, CIRS is a textbook example. In CIRS, patients experience symptoms that shift wildly and unpredictably. One day it's profound bedbound fatigue. The next day it's migrating joint pain. The next day it's severe cognitive issues, brain fog, and light sensitivity.
Which sounds crazy to a normal doctor.
Under the old organ assemblage model, this looks like hypochondria. It looks like chaos because no single organ is consistently failing. But under the coherence model, it makes perfect logical sense.
Because the entire system is on high alert.
The entire regulatory landscape is configured for defense. The symptoms shift based on which layer of the defense system is struggling the most to maintain homeostasis on any given day.
I want to take a second here to speak directly to you, the listener, especially if you or someone you love have been battling a mysterious multi-system illness for years.
It's so important to hear this.
What this model means is a bleak but profoundly validating reality. Your body is not broken. It isn't attacking itself randomly out of stupidity or genetic bad luck. It is actually successfully executing a highly evolved, multi-layered, brilliant defense program.
It's doing exactly what it was designed to do.
It is doing exactly what millions of years of evolution designed it to do to keep you alive during a massive threat. The problem is simply that it has lost the key to turn the program off. It is locked in.
It is locked in. And recognizing that it is a systemic lock-in rather than a single broken part is the absolute prerequisite for true healing.
Which brings us to a major pivot in the research. If chronic illness is the state of being locked in a defense program, how do we get out? We have to shift our focus from the mechanics of the problem to the biological logic of the solution.
Exactly. We need a way out of the lockdown. Let's talk about cellogenesis and what the text calls wu-wei medicine.
Cellogenesis. I had never heard that word before.
The paper introduces it as a term that, frankly, should be the philosophical foundation of all medical training. Pathogenesis is the study of how disease starts. Cellogenesis is the study of how health is created.
How health is created.
It posits that healing is not merely the suppression of symptoms or the removal of a pathogen. Healing is an active, sequence-dependent biological accomplishment.
Healing is an active process. It's the organism putting itself back together. It's the restoration of adaptive flow and systemic coherence. And to achieve cellogenesis, the authors advocate for an approach they call wu-wei medicine.
Wu-wei is a beautiful concept borrowed from ancient Chinese philosophy. It translates roughly to non-coercive action or effortless action.
Now, in the context of advanced biological medicine, this absolutely does not mean doing nothing. Doesn't mean sitting back, burning some sage, and just hoping the patient miraculously gets better.
No, not at all.
Right. It means aligning your clinical interventions with the organism's own natural conditions of recovery. It is the exact opposite of forcefully overriding the body's downstream outputs with heavy pharmaceuticals. You aren't just jamming a chemical wrench into the gears to force a symptom to stop.
We have to contrast it with coercive medicine. Coercive medicine is brilliant and necessary for acute crises. If your blood pressure spikes to 220 over 140, you are in imminent danger of a stroke.
You don't want wu-wei medicine, then?
No. You need a coercive pharmaceutical to force those blood vessels open right now, regardless of why they closed. You force the system to comply to save the life. But in chronic defensive lock-in, applying excessive force can backfire catastrophically.
Oh, so?
It can add to the organism's overall sense of alarm. Think about the mitochondria. If the body is purposefully withholding energy because the mitochondria believe they are under attack, giving that patient a massive stimulant to force them to be energetic is just going to panic the system further.
Oh, wow.
The mitochondria will perceive the forced energy burn as a deepening of the threat, and the subsequent crash will be devastating. Coercion worsens the fragmentation.
I love this concept, and I think I have a good way to visualize the difference. Imagine you walk into a room and your friend is in the middle of a severe hyperventilating panic attack.
Okay.
Coercive medicine in chronic illness is like walking up to that terrified friend, grabbing them aggressively by the shoulders, shaking them, and screaming in their face, "Calm down, relax your shoulders, breathe slower."
That's just going to make it worse.
Technically, you are addressing the symptom. They do need to be calm, and their shoulders are tense. But the aggressive, coercive method of delivery just adds massive amounts of stress to their already overloaded nervous system.
The intention is correct, but the mechanism of intervention is entirely counterproductive to the goal of safety.
Exactly. Wu-wei medicine, on the other hand, is like walking into that same room, seeing your friend in a panic, and taking non-coercive action. You turn down the blaring rock music on the stereo. You dim the harsh fluorescent lights. Maybe you open a window to let in some cool air.
You're changing the environment.
You sit down quietly on the floor next to them, and you just start taking slow, deep breath yourself. You aren't touching them. You aren't forcing them to be calm. You are manipulating the environment to create the conditions where calmness becomes a biological option for their nervous system. You are signaling safety.
That is a brilliant translation of the concept. Because practically, biologically, how do we apply that to the locked-in continuum? We have to reverse the lock-in by systematically signaling safety to each layer.
Right. How do we do that?
We relieve maladaptive mechanical strain in the fascial matrix. This might involve highly specific manual therapies, movement re-education, or fascial manipulation to physically remove the tension that is pulling on the cells.
So we soften the web.
We calm the boundary thresholds by rigorously identifying and removing dietary, toxic, or environmental triggers so the mast cells can finally stand down and stop firing inflammatory mediators.
We stop pouring gas on the fire.
We work to restore microvascular flow by supporting the health of the glycocalyx with specific nutrients and gentle, non-exhausting movement.
We rebuild the fuzzy forest.
And by doing all this, by softening the fascia, quieting the mast cells, and opening the blood vessels, we are finally sending a systemic, all-clear signal to the mitochondria.
The war is over.
We allow them to naturally shift out of the cell danger response and back into energy production and tissue repair. We don't force them. We convince them it is safe to turn the power grid back on.
And this approach completely redefines how we should think about preventative medicine. Prevention isn't just about taking a statin to manage a cholesterol number on a blood test.
No, that's just managing a biomarker.
True prevention is actively preserving the conditions that keep the organism from entering defensive lock-in in the first place. It's keeping the fascial matrix supple. Mm-hmm. It's keeping the mast cell boundaries calm. It's maintaining the integrity of the interfacial water.
Building resilience.
Which leads me to a massive, unavoidable question.
I think I know what it is.
If this coherent, interconnected model of the body makes so much logical sense, and if it is clearly supported by all this emerging peer-reviewed literature in mechanobiology, mitochondrial science, and microcirculation, why isn't this the standard of care? Why did it take an AI-assisted deep dive to pull this all together?
That is the ultimate question.
Yeah.
And to answer it, we have to pull back our lens from the microscopic cells and look at the macro structure of the medical system itself. We have to look at the political economy of knowledge.
This is fascinating. The research argues that the fragmentation of physiology, This stubborn insistence on keeping the body sliced up into different non-communicating specialties isn't just a historical accident. It is actively reinforced by institutional, commercial, and disciplinary incentives.
The term used here is epistemic closure.
Epistemic closure.
It refers to how a system of knowledge becomes sealed off from outside, paradigm-shifting information. The current medical research and economic ecology heavily rewards isolable mechanisms.
Meaning one single target.
It rewards finding one single tiny broken receptor pathway that can be targeted by one single patentable pharmaceutical molecule.
Because you can't patent lifestyle changes or facial manipulation.
Exactly. The system rewards downstream, specialty-specific interventions. The gastroenterologist is economically incentivized to do endoscopies and prescribe acid blockers. The rheumatologist is incentivized to prescribe highly profitable biologic immunosuppressants for joint pain.
It's all siloed.
There is a massively successful multi-billion-dollar economic model built entirely around managing the endless downstream outputs of defensive lock-in.
And just to be completely clear here, to the listener, the paper doesn't endorse any sort of, you know, anti-scientific populism or left-wing or right-wing political sides. It strictly advocates for rigorous epistemic hygiene and unbiased synthesis.
Yes. This isn't about villainizing traditional medicine or suggesting doctors have malicious intent. Doctors are doing their absolute best, working tirelessly within a framework they were taught.
They're just following the map they were given.
It is simply an impartial observation of how research funding shapes our view of reality. If you develop a therapy that treats the underlying substrate, a therapy that restores the electrical charge of interfacial water, or signals safety to the mitochondria through environmental modification, how do you enclose that within existing corporate profit models?
You generally don't. If the cure for a complex multi-system illness involves restoring systemic coherence through non-coercive means, nobody's making $1 billion a quarter on that.
The authors are very clear. Substrate level, preventive, and systems restorative questions are neglected, not because they are bad science or pseudoscience. They are neglected because they are economically inconvenient to commercialize.
So what's the solution?
The proposed solution is the creation of an epistemic commons. We need a shared, open intellectual space where researchers from the fascial world can talk directly to the mitochondrial biologists, where the microvascular experts can share data with the mast cell researchers.
Breaking down the silos?
And this must be done transparently without lowering any rigorous scientific evidentiary standards. We need a space to assemble the puzzle pieces that currently exist, but are locked away in completely different academic buildings.
Because discovering the absolute truth of human physiology isn't just about looking closer and closer through a microscope at a single cell. It is about stepping back, widening the lens, and seeing the connections between the systems.
That's the only way forward.
Wow. Okay. We have covered an absolutely incredible amount of ground today. We have journeyed from the absolute foundations of our physical anatomy to the philosophy of how medical knowledge is funded and constructed. Let's summarize this journey we've been on.
It's been a deep dive, for sure.
We started by tearing down the outdated idea that you are a biological bag of isolated organs. We rebuilt the body as a nested continuum, starting with the continuous fascial web and the fluid highways, the interstitium.
The RAIN model.
We discovered the mystery of interfacial water, how the fluid inside us isn't just passive liquid, but a structured, charged, gel-like medium that acts as the conductive wire for our internal communication.
The battery of the body.
We learned about biotensegrity and how our cells read the physical force and tension of our connective tissue to literally change their genetic destiny.
We then explored the active, intelligent borders of our blood vessels, the endothelial glycocalyx, and how damage to that fuzzy microscopic forest links diseases across the entire body by suffocating the microcirculation.
We zoomed into the mitochondria, revealing them not just as mindless energy factories, but as the executive directors of cellular defense, capable of shifting us into the cell danger response when they sense a threat, including psychological stress.
We looked at the mast cells, the ancient sentinels standing guard at our tissue boundaries, translating local alarms into systemic panic.
And we saw how all of these layers, the fascia, the water, the vessels, the mitochondria, and the mast cells can crash together into a self-perpetuating cycle of defensive lock-in. We redefined chronic, multi-system illness not as a broken machine, but as a body trapped in a successful defense program.
And crucially, we didn't stay in the dark.
No, we didn't. We found the way out through cellogenesis and Wu-Wei medicine, the non-coercive restoration of adaptive flow achieved by systematically signaling safety to the organism. I want to remind you, the listener, why absorbing all of this matters so deeply. This shouldn't just be an interesting intellectual exercise. This should fundamentally change how you view your own physical existence.
I completely agree.
The next time you feel a wave of inexplicable fatigue, a diffuse ache, or a flare-up of symptoms, I don't want you to think my body is a broken, failing machine. You are not a machine made of isolated parts that wear out. You are a continuous, highly intelligent, miraculously connected ecosystem. And right now, in this exact moment, that ecosystem is constantly reading the world, reading your stress, reading your environment, trying to decide if you are safe enough to heal.
Your body is always striving for coherence.
Yeah.
It never stops attempting to heal. Sometimes it just needs you to provide the right environmental signals so it can finally trust that the war is over.
And that leaves me with one final lingering thought for you to take away today. We've spent this entire time talking about how our cells, our fascial webs, and our mitochondria are constantly reading physical force, fluid flow, and psychological stress. They are reading the environment to decide if we are safe enough to open up, produce energy, and thrive.
It's a delicate balance.
But I want you to look around at the actual world we have built for ourselves. Look at the harsh, artificial fluorescent lights we sit under for 8 hours a day. Think about the sedentary, hunched-over desk jobs that literally freeze our fascial tensegrity network into rigid patterns of mechanical strain, constantly pulling on our cells and signaling damage.
It's an unnatural state.
Think about the highly processed, nutrient-poor, chemical-laden food that relentlessly bombards our delicate gut boundaries, keeping our mast cells in a state of hypervigilance. And think about the constant, inescapable pinging of our digital notifications, the endless news cycles, the social media algorithms dripping tiny, relentless hits of cortisol and adrenaline into our bloodstreams every few minutes of our waking lives.
The body never gets a break.
Exactly. If chronic illness is indeed a state of defensive lock-in, driven by a cellular system that believes it is constantly under siege, is it possible that modern human society is inadvertently but structurally engineered to keep our cellular alarm bells ringing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Are we desperately trying to achieve cellogenesis in a world fundamentally designed for perturbation? Think about that.